asking you to hold me just like the morning paper. Pitch between your pointer, your index and your thumb. It's a semi-automatic. Believers are ecstatic. You see the way they cling. The cold metallic sting. And I'm living in a coma. For Donna De Verona. The harness made of hopes. The lovers on the ropes. None is to church as the parrot is to perch. And my
listening to WRSCT Pittsburgh and WRSCT.org. Welcome to Ebony Spectrum. As we give you various news clips, we want to go back into the archives about 10 months ago. As we're talking about poverty in this country, here is Reverend Dr. William Barber on The Daily Show.
You, sir, are famously not white.
Well,
so why write white poverty?
Well, actually, I come from Caucasian, Black, and Tuscaroan descendant.
Oh, wow.
So, and my people were free people in Eastern North Carolina. There are a lot of those communities. And so in some ways, this book is me. And so to deny any part of my reality would be to deny myself. But here's the problem I'm concerned about. The way we measure poverty in this country is not only a lie, but I can say it on this show, it's a damn lie.
Sir, you can do more than that if you want.
Oh, okay.
We got plenty more room.
Got plenty room
for that.
Well,
yeah.
I only use the ones that are approved by the Bible.
Okay. You're reverent.
So we use the official poverty measure says that poverty, if you make above $13,000 a year, you're not poor.
If you make above
about $13,000 a year, you're not poor. You're kind of in the lower middle class.
When was the last time they adjusted?
Well, it's been since the 60s, really, in some ways. And so what happens with that is we marginalize poverty.
Right.
And then we racialize it. Whenever we have a brief discussion about poverty, because we very seldom have it in the news, in political arenas, we put up a Black woman on welfare, which racializes and demeans Black people, but then it dismisses tens of millions of white poor people.
You write there's 66 million.
66 million. Of the 135 million poor and low-wage people in this country, 60% of Black people are poor and low-wage. That's 26 million. 30% are white, but that's 66 million, 40 million more.
Right.
This book says we need to face all of our poor and recognize that we have something what Desmond, who's an author out of Princeton, calls poverty by America. Not the poverty in America,
sure,
but the particular kind of poverty by America that's unnecessary and abolishable, because it makes no sense in the richest nation in the world. We have over 135 million poor and low-wage people, over 41% of our population, and over 50% of our children. And it's unnecessary. So white poverty says we're not playing the game anymore.
Let's not look at this through the prism of race. Let's look at it through class. And do you think that division was a purposeful one?
I think so. And to expand race, you have to deal with race in America. But what you cannot allow someone to do for something this serious, where 295,000 people are dying a year from poverty and low wage.
How many?
295,000, 800 people a day.
Are dying.
Recent study, from poverty.
From what they would consider poverty.
Poverty is the fourth leading cause of death in the country. higher than respiratory disease. Higher than gun violence.
I imagine it even impacts respiratory disease, because if you're low wage and you're living in an area, exactly, chances are the pollution and the toxins are probably higher where you live.
All of those things.
Right.
And so here we have something that's a fourth leading cause of death, 800 people a day. When 7 people died from vaping, it was a congressional hearing. It was presidential level. Right? Imagine if 800 politicians were dying a day.
Oh, I have.
Well, I can't do that. But my point is how everybody would be just up and out, or
sure,
800 middle class people, or 800
wealthy people. 100,000 people, that's clearly epidemic.
Right, you just talked about crime. That's a crime. That's a form of, especially when it's unnecessary. It does not have
and
to
entrenched. Be. And entrenched. It seems in a lot of communities, it's a cloud that never lifts.
Well, the thing about it is, John, it's in every community. See, that's the point we're making in the book. Whether it's Appalachia, where I met women in West Virginia who have to sell tacos on Tuesdays so they have a community fund to help women deal with their monthly issues, or whether it's out in eastern Kentucky, where I met black and white coal miners who watched the mines be taken over by multinational companies that moved the union rights out of it, or whether it's in the Delta. It's everywhere. There's not a county in this country now where a person making $7.25, that's what the minimum wage is. Federal minimum wage is $7.25.
Right.
It's been like that for 14 years, John. It hasn't been raised for 14 years.
When they try and raise it to even 15, I mean, the fight is everywhere you go. There's a huge fight about trying to bring it to 15, and it's going to kill all the jobs.
Which is a lie.
You
know, three Nobel Peace Prize economists said it wouldn't kill jobs. In fact, it would put more money in the economy, and it would actually expand jobs. But here's the thing. We had 15 in a union proposed in 2020. 8 Democrats and every Republican stood against 55 million people. 55 million people who make, 52 million people who make less than a living wage of $15 an hour. Now, here's the thing. In 63, the March on Washington called for a raise of the minimum wage to $2, which indexed with inflation would be over 15 today.
Really?
Yeah.
And people forget the March on Washington in 63 was titled for
jobs and justice.
And justice.
It wasn't just about black civil rights. It was about a broad, inclusive, just field democracy.
Right.
And so here we are in this reality, and people are hurting everywhere. There's not a county where you can work a minimum wage job and afford a basic 2-bedroom apartment. And waiters and waitresses
on minimum wage.
On minimum wage.
Not a county in the country.
Not a county in the country.
You couldn't, if you had a minimum wage job, there's not a county in this country where you could afford a 2-bedroom.
Not a federal, no, you couldn't.
And so this is the working poor. This isn't, you know, I think in the country there's a sense of it's an entitlement mentality.
Oh, yeah.
That's why there's a certain character flaw that keeps you there. These are people that are working.
Yeah, the entitlement is, and then the politicians that keep raising their wages and giving corporations tax breaks, but they won't help the working people. That's the entitlement. And we're talking about during COVID. COVID did not exacerbate poverty, it exposed it.
Right.
And what we did a study called the death during COVID, and we found that whether you were in a poor county in West Virginia or a poor county in the Delta, poor people died at a rate 3 to 5 times higher during COVID because of their poverty, not because the germ somehow discriminated, but we did.
Access to good health care.
Right. Well, 350,000 people died during COVID so far. One study said from the lack of health care. And if you don't face this, John, this is the point of the book. We have to face this. We have to look at it. We had 15 presidential debates in the last election. 40% of the adult population in poverty, 800 people dying a day. Not one debate was focused on it. We've not had an Oval Office discussion.
Why don't politicians value what is an incredibly large population in many different, I'm sure, in swing states? So why don't they? Do poor people need better lobbyists? What is it that can be done to get a politician to listen?
Well, I think that what we're saying now is we just had a study. I asked it to be done as a part of our movement, Waking the Sleeping Giant. And this is what we found out, that all of these numbers also tell us that poor and low-wage people now represent 30% of the electorate in the country.
30%.
30%. And over 40% in states where the margin of victory was less than 3%. And it's Texas where it's less than 5%.
Wow.
So what we're saying to poor and low-wage people of every race is time to mobilize your vote. There's not a state where 20% of poor and low-wage voters that didn't vote, 57 million voted, 30 million didn't in the last election. But if 20% that didn't vote moved, they could change every election. And in most states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, mm-hmm. it's less than 4%. So what we're doing is organizing a massive movement. In fact, on June 29th in Washington, D.C., there's going to be a massive poor people, low-wage workers assembly and moral march to, on D.C. and to the polls, saying that poor and low-wage people
right.
have to find themselves, white, black, brown, Asian, Native, and unite around attacking what we call five interlocking injustices: systemic racism, systemic poverty, ecological devastation, denial of health care, the war economy, and the false modern act of religious nationalism.
Wow.
And John, you know, in our agenda, we're saying to Carlton, if you want these votes, bring them in at the top level. President Biden, bring a group of poor, low-wage folk and religious leaders to the White House.
Do people even listen to them? Do they even hear them? What has the response been when you reach out to our political class? What's the response been?
Well, because we've been lied to so much. You know, these at first they said, well, it's not that big. And then we proved that it's actually 135, 140 million. And then they don't expect that people are going to organize. You know, in a democracy, you have to engage in agitation, legislation, litigation, and voter participation. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying to poor and low-wage folks, let's use this power.
Right.
And so we're having this gathering before the conventions. We're going to touch 15 million poor and low-wage voters with the facts on where people stay in a nonpartisan,
right.
where they stand on the issues, and say, let's mobilize. And we, because that's the true swing vote. Celinda Lake, who's a major pollster, says the truest, most powerful, biggest swing vote right now is poor and low-wage people. And you know, John, folk often ask me, and you and I have talked about this, does our current society require that things be like this?
This was the real crux of the
yeah.
issue.
Yeah. And what this book says is, well, it's kind of like putting your hand in an electric socket that's connected. It requires that you get shocked. Because you put your finger there.
Right.
You don't have to do it. But if you keep doing things the way you are doing it, you're right. going to get shot. So if you keep paying less than a living wage, if you keep denying people health care, if you keep giving greedy, wealthy folk $2 trillion tax cuts, but you won't even spend the money to fully fund public education, if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep having the
right.
level of poverty that we're having. And we don't have to do it. It is actually, I believe, criminal, a form of a policy violence
right.
to continue down the road.
And doesn't it weaken the system as a whole? You know, you could almost make the case that if the system is requiring a permanent entrenched underclass, then it makes itself ripe for instability. And I'm wondering, is there a way to change the mindset? Because the mindset in America is there is a moocher class.
Oh, sure.
These poor people are moochers, and they're taking resources from me. I work hard. Poor people get health care, they get food, they get whatever they need. I don't get it. Is there a way to change the mentality to view things not as entitlements, but investments?
Yeah.
And maybe to get labor not to be viewed as shareholders, mm-hmm. that corporations have to view labor not as a means to an end, but as shareholders in that, and can that change the dynamic?
It can, but one of the first things that we believe we have to do, and we talk about moral fusion organizing,
mm-hmm.
is first of all, we should be examining every policy not by the color of a president's hair or how many porn stars he touched or how he what's the gait of his walk. Does the policies you propose, do they line up with establishing justice? Do they line up with providing for the common defense and promoting mm-hmm. the general welfare? Do they line up with our deepest moral religious values? Secondly, we must expose the level of death that's happening, because this is not benign. Thirdly, we must make sure that folks see it all, that it's not one group of people. We've been lied to so much about this is an anomaly. This is just a small group. We right. cannot allow this to be marginalized anymore. And then we must have massive organization of poor and low-wage people of every place, every geographic and every race. And in doing that, we can put poverty and low wages at the center of our political discourse. And then, yes,
isn't that America first? Isn't that making America great again? Like, if you hollow out a country, how can you expect it to be strong? Wouldn't that be the absolute acme of strengthening a country from the bottom up as opposed to the top down?
You would think it would be, but if you've got people that are still living when they first wrote the Constitution and said even poor white men that didn't own jobs or didn't own land couldn't vote, if you have people with that kind of mentality,
right.
that this should be an exclusive democracy rather than an inclusive. But listen, the numbers tell us, though, there are more of us. The thing is, you can't be lazy in a democracy. You got to fight like heaven.
I mean,
and what we're trying to show people, the numbers are there.
Right.
Listen, Wisconsin, margin of victory, 20,000 vote, number of poor, low-wage voters didn't vote, over a million.
Didn't vote.
Michigan, 10,000 votes. The number of poor, low-wage vote, a million. Pennsylvania, 40,000 votes determined the president. Number of poor, low-wage voter did about 2 million. North Carolina,
right.
160,000, over a million. So it's not a big lift. And the number one reason, though, we did a study called Waking the Sleeping Giant, that poor, low-wage people didn't vote. Nobody talks to them. Politicians don't go in those communities.
Right.
I've gone in communities and people literally cry and say, Reverend Barber, nobody comes back here. And so what I say to them is, we're back here now, but let's mobilize to make sure they never forget you again. That they never forget you ever again.
White Poverty, available now. Reverend Barber will be leading the Poor People's Campaign's March on Washington, June 29th.
Next up, we have Monique from the Don Lemon group. You know, Don is online now, just like Joy Reid is and several other people, because they're not on mainstream media. So we have Monique running it down for you.
Welcome, Lemonation. I'm Monique Presley, and you know what time it is. It's time for The Week with Monique. That one time during the week where I come to you with the one thing in the news or the one or two things in the news that I think out of the whole week of what's going on, you should be paying attention to. And man, am I excited, guys. I am excited to actually have good news that is The Week with Monique's pick. We got a black pope, y'all. Did y'all know that? Did y'all know that we have the first black pope? Okay, who am I talking about? If you've been under a rock, then you don't know. And I will tell you that Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost was selected at the conclave of all of the cardinals of the Roman Catholic Church around the world. He was elected to be the new pope after the loss of Pope Francis, and he has taken the name Pope Leo the 14th. That will be his new name, his pope name. And why am I saying that he's the first black pope? Is he the first black pope? I don't know. You decide. He is the first Augustinian pope. That's important. That's important, following in the tradition and legacy of Saint Augustine. And he is the second Roman pontiff after Pope Francis, who is from the Americas. But he is the very first to be from the United States of America. He is a Chicago native by way of parents in New Orleans, Louisiana. He was born to a father of French and Italian descent, Louise Marius Prevost, and a mother of Creole and Spanish descent, Mildred Bacquier Martinez. Y'all get where I'm going with this. He's got two brothers in the States, and I hope that they have security at this point because people are so mad now that they found out who our Pope is. Yes, he is of Creole descent, guys. And you know, here in the States, we follow that one drop rule. So I don't know any Black Catholic, especially, who's not claiming former Cardinal Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV, as their very own. He has a rich history. Very well educated, seminary, PhD, legal, you name it. He is very well educated. He traveled up through the ranks in the Roman Catholic Church and church system, and he was given significant responsibility by his predecessor, Pope Francis. And the importance of him choosing the name Pope Leo. I don't know if you guys know this about the Catholic Church, but when the new Pope picks their name, when they leave their cardinal responsibilities and their given name, their birth name, and choose a name in the Pope lineage, the name that they choose says a lot about their thought process, their ideology, their intention. They're setting an intention, the road that they're going to follow as Pope. It means one thing if they choose John Paul, it means another thing. If they choose Francis, it means another thing. If they choose Benedict, and it means yet another thing if they choose Leo. I want to talk to you about the OG Pope Leo so that you can have an understanding. Pope Leo XIII, the OG Pope Leo was known as the Roman Catholic Social Justice Pope. Social justice, is that something we need now more than ever? Absolutely. He was well known for his intellectualism. He was known for his attempts to define the position of the Catholic Church with regard to modern thinking. He had a very famous encyclical. That's a famous writing in the Catholic Church. It was Rerum Novarum, where he outlined the rights of workers to a fair wage, safe working condition, and was in favor and support of the formation of trade unions, while affirming the rights to property and free enterprise. He went in great detail on why there were all the good right reasons for that to happen. If you look up the Vatican, you can go and read the entire thing if you're interested and want to know more. And he became popularly known as the Social Pope and the Pope of the Workers, also having created the foundations for modern thinking and the social doctrines of the Catholic Church. So here comes our new Pope Leo, choosing to follow in the tradition of the social justice Pope. And let me tell you, he didn't just oops and uh-oh and decide to do that yesterday. That's the way that he has been conducting himself as a cardinal. That's the way that he conducted himself as a minor of the Augustinian order. And if you look, even when he places his bio places, like maybe on Twitter, if it's still up, I don't know if it's still up. It's hilarious to me if people haven't checked it out yet. Go check out Robert Prevost, Cardinal Robert Prevost Twitter feed. But anyway, the first thing that he says is that he is an Augustino. He is an Augustinian because of the importance of that in the church. And I want to just read, pop up a little bit if I can for you, of some of the things, the interesting things that he said previously before he became the Pope. He had some interesting things to say by way of repost about our Vice President J.D. Vance and how he was incorrect and was reposting something from AmericaMagazine.org saying that Pope Francis' letter, J.D. Vance's Ordo Amoris, and what the gospel asks of all of us on immigration. You know, Pope Francis was a staunch critic of Vance's stand, and apparently this new Pope is as well. He also reposted from ncronline.org an article that was explaining how J.D. Vance is wrong. Jesus doesn't ask us to rank our love for others. That was one of his recent reposts. These two were back in February. His very last repost very, very last one was 6:47 p.m., April 14th, just a few weeks ago, 2025. He reposts Rocco Palmo's post that says, as Trump and Bukele use oval 2 emoji face for laughing, feds illicit deportation of a U.S. resident, once an undocked Salvadorian himself. Now, D.C. Oxen Avilio asks, do you not see the suffering? Is your conscience not disturbed? How can you stay quiet? That's the new Pope, y'all. And I just want to share one more, because if you look back about 5 years to a week that was critical and a turning point in this country for social justice, for civil rights, the week of the death of George Floyd. He was murdered on May 25th, 2020. And on May the 30th, the Pope, in his own words, said this, responding to someone else's tweet. Thank you. We need to hear more from leaders in the church to reject racism and seek justice. That's the Cardinal in his own words. That's what he has to say about what it means to be in the church, to be a leader, and obviously standing against the statements by our current executive branch, President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. So I believe that this is good news. There are those who have said the only way we would ever end up with an American Pope would be if American leadership was on the decline, if politically America was not strong, because the Roman Catholic Church would not pick an American to lead it while we also had America leading the political landscape and leading the economic landscape. So they look at this as if it is confirmation of the decline of American preeminence around the world, because the Catholic Church was confident enough that they could pick the opposite of our current leadership and choose that opposite in order to lead the Roman Catholic Church. Again, the leader of the Roman Catholic Church is the Bishop of Rome, but is also the head of the Roman Catholic Church around the world, millions of people around the world, and is also a geopolitical leader and a force. What is said by the Pope matters, and I am looking forward to what this Pope is going to have to say. I want to explain a little bit, my second to the last thing, of what it means to be an Augustinian. St. Augustine refers to two distinct but significant figures, St. Augustine of Hippo, a renowned theologian and Bishop of Hippo, and St. Augustine of Canterbury, a key figure in the spread of Christianity. St. Augustine of Hippo, the one for whom the order is formed, was a highly influential Christian thinker who shaped Christian doctrine and practice. Born in Tagaste, North Africa, in 354 AD, he became a prominent theologian, writer, and preacher, significantly impacting Christian thought and shaping the medieval world. He was a prolific writer. He penned numerous sermons, letters, and treatises, and was a defender of Catholic doctrines. He also influenced the practice of biblical exegesis. He was one of the most influential Christian thinkers. After St. Paul, his work is still studied and valued. But it matters to me, and I couldn't finish the day without sharing why all of this matters in a personal manner to me. I was raised Roman Catholic. My parents are still devout Roman Catholics. We come from huge, big Catholic family out of Louisiana. And my godfather, Father John Nathan Leboeuf, was a Roman Catholic priest. He's no longer with us. But if I had to think of, other than my parents, someone who walked the earth, who played a critical role in who I am today, there would be none that I would mention over Father John Leboeuf. He was a Roman Catholic priest in Mississippi. He was instrumental in the civil rights area. He worked with activists in Hattiesburg and Mount Bayou to promote voter registration among the communities. He had traveled the world. He was fluent in multiple languages. He was a gift in my life and an influence at just pivotal times from birth all the way until he transitioned. He was such an important person, and I have so many memories of great conversations, of graduations, of my Holy Communion, him being there, of my confirmation, of my graduation from college, and him taking the time to come. I remember the talks that we had and all of the things that he explained to me that shaped the way that I see the world. And I just can't imagine, for all of the history that he made as a Black Catholic priest who was preeminent around the world in the SVD order and as an Augustinian, because in fact, the same minor seminary that the new Pope Leo attended, St. Augustine Seminary in Bay St. Louis, Missouri, was where my godfather attended several years prior, but the same place. So I feel like I've got a handle on this new Pope, and it's a good one. So it delights me to be able to devote and dedicate this particular week with Monique to my godfather, Father John LeBeauf. That's all I have for today. Thanks for joining. I look forward to coming to you again next week, 2 p.m. Eastern, with The Week with Monique. Please subscribe to my channel, the Monique Pressley channel, where we do Make It Make Sense with Monique Pressley, Monday through Friday, noon Eastern. And of course, keep coming right back here to the Don Lemon channel, Don Lemon Nation. We love you, Don. We're praying for you and lifting you up in the loss of your sister. And we look forward to you being back with us soon.
One of the stories for this week is the arrest of Ross Baraka, Mayor Ross Baraka of Newark, at an ICE facility.
Congresswoman, you are still on the scene. Can you just tell us what you know now at this point? What has transpired since Mayor Baraka has been arrested? And while you're talking, we might also throw on the screen the video, the B-roll of the moment where you all surrounded the mayor so our viewers can see it.
And so thank you for having us, and most assuredly, thank you for making this information available to millions of people in our country, because you're absolutely right. Our rights are being taken away. And if they can do what they did to Mayor Baraka, and if they do what they did to the three of us, LaMonica, Rob, and me, then they can do it to anybody. And they are doing it to anybody and everybody. First of all, we're at a different site right now. This is not the site of the detention facility where we were trying to conduct an oversight interview and look at the facility. It's something that Rob and LaMonica and I had been doing. It's an ICE detention facility. We wanted to make sure everyone was comfortable, the place was clean, and individuals had access to phones and their attorneys. It basically was a clean facility. They don't have all the access that they are entitled to, but they're kind of gearing up. We waited for over an hour to be addressed by ICE, even though we had the authority to be there, even though we only wanted to make a tour. While we were in the waiting area, all of the ICE officials from the state of New Jersey at the highest levels came to the detention facility, and we thought it was to resolve our issue of taking the tour. So they came, they said hello, and the next thing we saw, they ran outside. We went outside, and we saw that the mayor was there. And the mayor was talking to them, to some of the ICE employees. He was invited inside of the gate to have the conversation. When we all got down there to the end, they told him that he had to go back into the public area where the protesters were, and he willingly, quietly, and respectfully did as they asked. While he was there, we were walking back to the holding facility thinking that we were going to have our interview and do our tour. But we noticed that ICE and officials were huddling and having a discussion. So we decided that we were going to kind of wait and see what was going on. They were talking to people on the phone. Now, mind you, all of the ICE leadership in the state of New Jersey was at that facility, but they were on the phone with someone. And we finally heard, okay, we're going to arrest the mayor. To which we said, why are you arresting the mayor? The mayor is not on your property. The mayor is out there with the protesters. They ignored us. They went out there. They tried to grab him. LaMonica, Rob, and I tried to hold on to the mayor to protect him. And we kept asking, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why are you doing this? So they actually, quite frankly, started roughing us all up. They took the mayor, finally. The mayor went. They arrested him. They cuffed him. It was disgusting to watch. And they brought him to this facility where we are now, which is their, I think, administration facility. We have been outside here now since they brought him here, trying to get a hearing for him or trying to get him released. And people have been coming and coming and coming. This place is flooded with protests and with media right now, because everyone is, first of all, we're scared. We're scared that nobody is safe in this country anymore. We're scared that Donald Trump has weaponized law enforcement, and law enforcement has no respect for any of us, irrespective of our positions. And we're scared for everyday folks just minding their business, going to school, working and walking. And so we decide that we're going to be here until we find out how the mayor is going to get released. I've just been informed that he is going to be released. We will be here until we physically see that happening. But this is un-American. This breaks my heart that in the United States of America, as imperfect as it has been, there's never been this disrespect for individual rights, for positions, or for just justice in general.
Congresswoman, it's so disheartening and yet compelling to hear you describe the events surrounding the arrest of the mayor. I want to call your attention to something that's very important and you know very well, and you've alluded to this throughout your comments there, that the rules of engagement that are laid out specifically, and everyone go see them at, you know, ice.gov, right? Regarding those facilities says, quote, nothing in this section may be construed to require a member of Congress to provide prior notice of the intent to enter a facility described in subsection A for the purpose of conducting oversight, for the purpose of doing your job as a member of Congress. You are not precluded nor prohibited. The fact that this administration yet again flouts the law, throws it up in the face of the American people and the very members who swore the same oath of office that they swore to uphold that law tells you what? What does that tell you when you get back to Congress and you're on the floor next week? What does it tell you you need to make your fellow members aware of regarding the actions of this administration?
Well, I just have to remind them just how corrupt this administration is as it relates to the rule of law and almost everything else, Michael. But I also need to talk to them about the difficulty that we had in gaining access to the facilities, the three of us who are members of Congress, because you cited the law. We cited the law. We've had conversations with ICE before in visiting their facilities. So we don't understand why they were so hyper determined to be so uncooperative this time. But there was a sort of an environment that was very unsettling. They were not respectful. ICE was not respectful at all. They barely responded to any question that we asked. And they never apologized when we were on the tour for having roughed us up, disrespected the mayor, taken him off. And this is not our country. This is not what we live for, fight for, stand for. Michael, this is such an abuse that we are experiencing at the highest levels, that they're giving people permission to take other people's rights simply because they don't like us. And so if members of Congress aren't even safe in this environment, we had pins, we had identification, they knew who we were, then what are we expecting other people to think and feel? So I'll go back to Congress. I'm going to talk about the fact of our experience, although we're communicating with them now about that. Also want to talk about it couldn't be that difficult when members of Congress show up to a detention facility to bring them in and let them do the tour that they're legally entitled to do. There's too much checking and double checking and pushing aside, and it was just too much confusion, unnecessary chaos. I know this is a chaotic administration. I know it's an intentionally cruel administration. I see it. I physically and personally experienced it today. And to take the mayor of the largest city in the state of New Jersey and put him in handcuffs and then take him away, and his mother, God bless her soul, in addition to his wife, his mother is here. And she has been here since they brought him here. This is not America. This is the sick man's idea of what he thinks he can do to any one of us or all of us that he doesn't like.
Congresswoman Bonnie Watson-Coleman, real quickly, just before I let you go, I want to clarify a point that you made earlier in the interview. Did you say that ICE invited the mayor to this facility?
He was invited inside of the gate. So there's a great big like parking area. So he was invited inside of the gate because they wanted to talk to him about what he wanted and why he was there. So when we got to him, he was still inside of the gate. But then ICE came and said, you're trespassing. You have to get leave here. You've got to get out of this area. The mayor walked away, went behind the fence, and was out there with other protesters. He was not on their properties. But they decided, for some performative reasons, some evil reasons, to go and handcuff him, humiliate him, and take him away.
Mayor, it is great to see you. I know you have had quite a day. First, let me just ask you how you're doing right now.
I'm okay, a little tired, but doing pretty good. Thank you. Thank God.
Thank God for that. I know you're back with your family. I know you have been charged with trespassing, which just seems completely insane. We've seen the video. We just spoke with Congresswoman Bonnie Watson-Coleman, who was there with you today. And she said you were on public property at the time of your arrest. She also said that you left the premises when officers asked you to. Were you told at all why you were charged with trespassing?
No, they charged me, I guess, based on the charges they can find. We was actually allowed on the property in the first place. Nothing happened for a long, long time. For at least over an hour. And then, after they finally told us to leave and I told them I was leaving, they came outside the gate and arrested me. So it looked like it was targeted.
It certainly looked like that from watching, and I know there's lots of questions I'm sure you have, we all have. Have you heard, are those charges still pending? Have they been dropped? Have you been given any indication of that?
No, they haven't been dropped. I can't completely talk about the particulars of the case, they said, but I have to appear in court again. So they have not dropped the charges. I've been charged with a Class C misdemeanor, a federal trespass.
That is, let me ask you, you were detained for a couple of hours today. I mean, where were you detained after you were arrested?
I was in a Homeland Security kind of barracks, a cell that they have there. I was being held there. And the guys from Homeland Security were very gracious, very respectful, treated me with respect and integrity. So I have nothing but respect for those guys. But, you know, it was still a uncomfortable and, you know, a humiliating situation for me.
Absolutely. I mean, you had, again, I'll just restate this, every right to be there. The delegation had every right to visit this facility. I know you've been trying to call attention to this facility and wanting the delegation to gain access to it, which they have every right to do. What, tell us about why and what concerns you might have that you want people to be aware of.
Well, our concern is with GEO, the group that's getting $63 million on this contract annually. They came into the city. They have a CO from 20 years ago. The city's law say you need to have a new CO, an updated CO. They refused to do that. So we're in dispute about that in court. They wouldn't allow the federal inspector, they wouldn't allow, excuse me, the health inspectors, the UCC inspectors, or the fire inspectors into the building, which is why we began coming down there regularly. I was just down there this morning. Actually, we go down there for like 15 minutes, try to get entry. They say no. We give them a citation. We're in the process of being in court. We're in court now. You know, they are violating, just doing what they want to do, really, without respecting our authority or the laws of the city or the state. And the reality is we're in a dispute. Like, they have one point of view, we have another point of view. But disputes are settled in court. Like, ICE doesn't settle our disputes, neither does the President of the United States, nor does the U.S. Attorney. Disputes are settled in a court of law, which is what we were doing. They, you know, taking a leave from the President of the United States, they feel like they could just violate any court and do whatever they want.
You know, you had a harrowing day, an absurd day today. I think a day that's really outraged a lot of people, including myself. Have you thought about taking any legal action in light of what took place today and what happened to you?
Well, I mean, we're going through this process now. And obviously, I will confer with my lawyers to figure out what's the best pathway forward on this. I think they completely violated my rights. I'm the mayor of the city. I have the right to go anywhere in this city. Particularly in places where I think our laws are being violated. I went on up on in a driveway with our federal healthcare inspectors and our fire inspectors early on, and we've been doing that for the last couple of days. They've been ignoring us. And actually the Congress people who have oversight on this went onto the property and tried to get inside, and they made them wait over an hour and they never got in. Never.
They mentioned that, and one of the things that the congresswoman I spoke with alluded to is that she thinks they were tipped off, that perhaps they were tipped off to you coming. I don't know. Of course, this all needs to be looked into, but the nature of your arrest with masked members of ICE just felt, and we've all seen the video, I mean, incredibly suspect, just watching it.
It was terrible.
Go ahead.
They obviously targeted me. It was more than I wasn't the only one out there. They came directly to me, right? And tried to arrest me. No one else, me. And so I honestly believe, you know, I was targeted there. And, you know, it's interesting to see all these people making these comments on social media, you know, from the government about why I was there. I didn't come down here to protest. I came down here for a press conference with the Congress people. I knew I was going to get in the building with them. I was waiting for them to return from outside of the building to participate in the press conference with them. I was already there earlier that morning. I didn't need to. If I wanted to protest, I could have protested that morning.
I don't know if you've seen Alina Haba's comments, and I can ask our team if they have them. We can perhaps play them. But to your point, the administration has been out there lying about what the members of Congress were there for and what you were there for. Have you seen any of what they've said publicly? It sounds like you have.
I have. I've seen it. The members of Congress didn't come down here to protest. They came down here to get a tour of the building. They made them wait over an hour. I was waiting outside for them to return so I could be a part of a press conference that they were having after it to talk to us about what they actually saw in the building. Unfortunately, none of that got to take place because the gentleman you see in his photo, the video had completely escalated this situation to a point where it didn't need to be.
Mayor Barack, I know you've had quite a long day. Before I let you go, do you have any plans to go back to this ICE facility or perhaps ask the governor or senators to go back tomorrow or the next day?
Well, I think all of these elected officials of good conscience should go down there. I think all of our congressional delegation should be there. I think the senators, U.S. senators, should be at this place, considering what happened to our congresspeople, that they need to be there. I think state officials need to be there as well. Our governor and other state officials need to be at this site. This is disturbing what they think they have the ability to do, and what they actually did today was terrible.
Mayor.
So, yep.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I continue. I just was going to just thank you and just really appreciate you taking the time tonight. Thank you so much, yeah. Newark, New Jersey Mayor Roz Baraka. Appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Saturday and I'm late, but here's the brief. Now, do you remember when we said a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere? Or that none of us are free until all of us are free? Or even in less philosophical, dated terms, if they're going to do it to somebody over there, they will in fact do it to your black ass right here? I hate to tell y'all, but our black asses have entered the chat. Yeah. And forgive my language, because I don't want to refer to anybody as a nigga that don't want to be referred to as a nigga, but I'm trying to reach a target audience here, so bear with me. They done arrested a gubernatorial ass nigga. Let me take it back. When I say they, I mean ICE. Now, earlier this week, we saw a clip go viral about a woman and her children in Massachusetts. A woman was clinging on to her baby, get detained by ICE. They're trying to rip her and her baby apart. Her teenage daughter running down the street screaming after them, also detained by ICE. But you also have neighbors, human beings who have empathy and are willing to put their bodies on the line, trying to position themselves between the family and ICE, or demanding for them to show ID, and ICE saying they don't got to show them nothing. Why does ICE feel so bold right now? I'm going to tell you why. Senator Chris Murphy was just on the Senate floor going off on Kristi Noem. I don't know her name. Don't give a fuck. But she is the Secretary for Homeland Security, and basically exposing to the public what Homeland Security has been doing. Now, they have been allocating all of their funds to ICE. When I say all their funds, I mean all their funds. They have been denying the use of funds already allocated by Congress prior to all of this BS. Not putting in places it needs to go, leaving us vulnerable in places, namely in cybersecurity. So China and Russia having a field day, are spinning narratives to say they've had less instances or they've had less incidents on the border. That's only because ICE has been acting illegally. And in fact, not even illegally in the name of getting criminals off the street. ICE is detaining anybody they want to detain because they're brown. These people could be perfectly legal permanent residents waiting on their visa, or whatever other cases involve you being a legal immigrant here in the United States. If you're brown and you don't follow certain criteria that they feel on a given space and time, they're taking you off the street. We've already seen them take students and protesters off the street. And now they've come for a mayor of Newark, New Jersey. Roz Baraka was doing his due diligence, protesting peacefully outside of an ICE detention center in New Jersey because they were also operating unconstitutionally and outside of their jurisdiction. And when ICE had had enough of his presence along with other protesters, they came in there and they got him. They also put their hands on two federal employees, two Congress folks from New Jersey as well. And if you look at the video of Roz Baraka getting arrested, you have all of these ICE, which mind you stands for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, not police, don't have the right to put their hands on American citizens, much less federal employees, are detaining these people, putting their hands on these folks, and they do not care. Now, why does this matter to you? Again, I put emphasis on gubernatorial because this man is running for governor. And this authoritarian regime is emboldening a group of people who do not have the right to arrest nobody outside of people breaking immigration law and putting them in jail. Roz Baraka is out of jail now, praise God. You may have thought up until this point that voting did not matter, but guess what? Do you wanna know why Kristi Noem and anybody else in the Homeland Security Office who is doing things illegally, promoting unconstitutional behavior, isn't being arrested? Because when we allowed Trump to be elected, he also selected the Attorney General, and that Attorney General heads up the Department of Justice. They not arrested nobody. What's wild to me is that what people seem to be forgetting or misunderstanding in the onslaught of information and this and the speed at which this information is coming. The president of the United States is not legally allowed to do any of these things. But again, when we allowed him to be elected, we allowed someone with immunity to be elected. Yeah, so it doesn't matter if he's doing illegal shit or not. But the thing about it is, he's got agencies just doing what he says, whether it's illegal or not. So what's gonna have to happen is, I'm not even just saying it's voting anymore. Voting is always a part of the solution. Voting is always a part of the solution. I'm going to stand on that. But what I'm also saying, we're going to need some people who are willing to buck the system and protect the American people. Police officers and police chiefs who are willing to stand and face. If you firmly believe that not all cops are bastards, this is your time. Because when you look at the videos of these people being arrested, there is nobody that is able to keep ICE's hands off them and detaining people, because ICE is just taking the authority. They're only going to respect somebody else in uniform. Maybe not even that, but it can't just be us. It can't even be just elected officials at this point, is what I'm saying. We're going to need people willing to buck the system, because what the president is doing is illegal. I don't even really have a bigger point outside of that. What the president of the United States is doing is illegal and unconstitutional. And we're going to need people who are in places of power, who are being affected by this authoritarian regime, this rollout, everybody just getting on board. I need y'all to be on the boat and then turncoat. Yeah. That's all I got.
Thank you so much to my amazing colleague from the great state of California. Mr. Speaker, I rise today with a simple but clear message. First of all, I just gotta clear up a few things. Instead of the president cosplaying as the next pope, he may want to try to cosplay as an actual president of these United States. That means that he may have to do a little bit of research and decide that he wants to understand that he swore an oath. And this oath was to protect and defend the Constitution. That is the oath that he was supposedly taking on January 20th, as well as we may want the president to look into what the Declaration of Independence was about. We may want him to understand that that was a foundational document as relates to self-determination of those who had recently gained their independence from Great Britain. I would hope that he would maybe spend a few of these days in this first 100 days, and it is sad to say that it's his second term, that he doesn't understand that the Declaration of Independence is about this idea that we are entitled to the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's all of us that are here. But let's go through some of the things that he did manage to do and some of the havoc that he has managed to wreak. In the first 100 days of Trump administration, we have had to unfortunately endure a lot of pain. This administration clearly is not ready to lead. They are only here to tear down. In just 100 days, we've witnessed an administration hell-bent on dismantling the very systems designed to protect the most vulnerable amongst us. And for Black Americans, those of us who have always carried the weight of a broken system and bad policies, the danger is real, it's tangible, and it is urgent. Let me be clear, the last 100 days have not been an accident or a fluke. He has done exactly what he said he was going to do. He gave us the blueprint in Project 2025. Some tried to warn us of the dangers, and well, here we are. Let's talk about education. Within weeks of taking office, the Department of Education quietly rescinded guidance encouraging schools to teach honest, inclusive Black history. Instead, they're attempting to whitewash history and have begun promoting so-called patriotic education, a sanitized version of history that skips over slavery, Jim Crow, redlining, and systemic racism. He signed an executive order reinstating, quote, common sense discipline practices in school, rolling back previous administration's attempts to address racial disparities in school discipline practices. Make no mistake, these decisions have a direct impact on Black children, children who deserve a fair shot to learn in safe and supportive environments. Let's talk about housing. HUD announced plans to gut fair housing rules meant to fight discrimination. You know, the same ones that he violated back when he was a landlord so many years ago. Yeah, those same rules that were supposed to fight discrimination in lending and zoning. This means there will be even more roadblocks for Black families trying to buy a home and yet another generation locked out of building wealth.
Let's talk about public safety. While they're cutting after-school programs and community violence prevention, they are pouring millions of dollars into militarizing police departments. They're criminalizing our communities while stripping away the very resources that keep us safe. And finally, money talks, so let's talk money. This administration slashed funding of seven government agencies that provide Black communities with educational materials and economic opportunities, including the Minority Business Development Agency, the only federal agency dedicated to uplifting minority businesses. This agency helped entrepreneurs all across the country, including in my own district, keep their doors open and their workers employed. Now, it's under attack. And while all of this is happening, they're dismantling environmental protections and environmental justice, slashing funding for HBCUs, and rolling back civil rights enforcement across federal agencies. Let me repeat what that means. To roll back civil rights enforcement across federal agencies. This is the so-called DEI attacks that we continue to endure in this country. This is their way of trying to roll back the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that so many died and bled for. Mr. Speaker, this is not just about policy disagreement. This is about direct attacks on Black futures, Black prosperity, and Black freedom. This is about right versus wrong, point blank. But here's what they don't understand. We've seen this playbook, and every time they've attempted to silence us, erase us, and hold us down, we've resisted and we've pushed this country closer to the ideals it claims to hold. They are trying to bury us, but what they don't realize is that we are seeds and still we rise. I stand here a proud Black woman and a proud member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and I refuse to stand by while this administration tries to turn back the hands of time. We will resist. We will continue speaking truth to power, and we will keep organizing until everybody is free. Because in the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, nobody's free until everybody's free.